Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Plato, a reading from and through the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers. So this encyclopedia is sort of like a guide for people who only know philosophy or specialize in philosophy for grounding in there. It's not a general encyclopedia, so it doesn't give detailed historic bibliography, mathematical science implications, and so for various philosophers it's either strong or weak or focused or unfocused or stuff like that. But for Plato, I think they're right in their element. So Plato is the philosopher who looked at the study of philosophy and its origin of it, and he had an unusual method of doing it. This is with these, if you can imagine, not telemovies, which are sort of plays, more on scripts. If you can imagine, his dialogue is like a movie script, and in a place where there's not a distribution of movies, or there is a distribution of movies, it's limited, you get a much greater view of scripts. And these dialogues are just movie scripts, probably boring movies, but it allows someone to spend pages and pages going into detail exploring what the character does. So it's sort of a more liberated view. So you've got Plato here, and then what was he trying to say and do? And sort of two major themes. One is whether people actually got the actual fundamental idea of what an abstract idea was, and an abstract idea in society and philosophy. So he looked into that, and his view of an abstract idea is something called a form, and how much you could actually deduce from a form, or from the abstract idea, do you therefore reflect yourself as an abstract entity having with the soul, or are you just a concrete person? You know, it's one of those things to go across. And the fact that he wrote movie scripts is that to what extent, they've asked, is his characters in the movie scripts his actual beliefs, or just is he writing in character, or and if these characters change their moods, what's going on? And essentially, although you can have 1,000 different characters, but there's a leading lady, a protagonist, there's M, like in the James Bond movie, you can have lots of different James Bonds and lots of different villains happening in with it, and it's a device which is used again and again. So Galileo used the device of a play, writing up a play, which no one performed, but it's a script of a play that someone read, and when they read the script, they didn't see it performed, when they read it, his Simplicio is a so it's a time-honored form which has now disappeared, and you can pick this up. So there's heaps of different things. We've got various birds going up here in the surrounding. Even Newton had poems. People were writing poems in Latin, and Latin is not your common language. It was like a performance, an era of performance. And when you read scientific commentary, there's these things that seen as entertainment for different audiences. So when Newton came out, they had Newton explained for the ladies, a ladies' version, which of course the people secretly, everyone read to see if they could try and understand it, because Newton himself didn't actually try and explain what was going on. And so Plato himself didn't settle down and try and explain things. So the idea of it's sort of like a product manual for thinking. This product manual is more like a set of themed books to read about it, whereas other philosophers further down the track produced something much more like a product manual for thinking, you know, with the frequently asked questions and various things. So it took a while for this to get off and going. So here we are. Now we're going up to the final thing, episode 4. I just ran out of steam and time last time to polish this off in 3 episodes. Three episodes, and this one is the last section of questions, and that is, so we should just do another step back. That Socrates was the entire idea of a person who is not obsessed with himself and building himself up. He brought the theory of asking questions and talking about things and entertaining people and seeing that people brought to you not money but the gift of their experience, and they could give some experience to you and you could give back some arrangement, some self-reflection, a much deeper thing. And of course Socrates, in the process, it's hard to say, the logic of the process is that he had to die, and he recognized that and killed himself, or committed suicide under order. Now, why the dialogues? It is equally unrealistic. This is why the scripts, the play scripts. So a dialogue is really a play script. Dialogue is he said, I said, so it moves to stage left, stage right. That is what a dialogue is. It's quite entertaining to do. It's hard work. I'm going to see if I can go through the Republic. Easily my favorite, most accessible, probably the Laws. All the dialogues are scripts, and you've got to read it like that. But of course, the Republic, with the allegory of the boat in it. So they go off into little scenes. It's really good. But I'll go and try and read the Republic, but I'm not going to print it out. I'm going to see if I can get the library to get me one. So I've decided that I'll do a few instructive podcasts, and I'll actually see if I can get the library to produce it. It's a very interesting thing, libraries. Okay, it was equally unrealistic to suppose that when Plato embarked on his career as a writer, he made a conscious decision to put all his compositions that he would henceforth compose in a general reading public, with the exception of the Apology, in the form of a dialogue. If the question, why did Plato write dialogues, which many of his readers attempt to ask, presupposes that... there must have been some such once and for all decision. Then it's poorly posed. I think if you've gone into the dialogue genre, your intellectual assets are in the dialogue form. So I don't know. What makes better sense to break the question apart into many little ones? Better ask, why did Plato write this particular work? For example, Protagoras or the Republic or Symposium or the Laws in the form of a dialogue. And that one, Thomas, say, mostly in the form of a long, rhetorical, elaborate single speech, since to ask why he decided to adopt the dialogue form. I think, well, I've got a simple answer. The dialogue is non-resolved. It's a thesis in working, like your PhD thesis. A couple of months out, you have 3 or 4 themes, and you have to wrap it together for the thesis, but... it's still quite valuable for a few months out. The best way to form a reasonable conjecture about why Plato wrote any given works in a form of a dialogue is to ask, what would be lost were one to attempt to rewrite this work in a way that eliminated the give or take of the interchange, stripped the characters of their personalities and social markers, and transferred the result into something that comes straight from the mouth of his author? Well, I think you've got the answer there, my friend, because he's writing for a general public, so... this is the great thing about a movie. You can have all walks of life coming to see a movie, and because it's not directed at them, they can actually take away what they will. This is often a question that would be that will be easy to answer, but the answer may vary greatly from one dialogue to another. In pursuing this strategy, we must not rule out the possibility that some of Plato's reasons for writing this or that work in the form of dialogues will also be the reason for doing so in other cases, perhaps. Some of his reasons, so far as we can guess them, will present in all other cases. For example, the use of characters and conversations allowed the author to enliven his work, to awaken interest in the readership, and therefore reach a wider audience, which is basically what I said about, you know, a film, a blockbuster film, box office. The enormous appeal of Plato's writing is the part, the result of their dramatic composition. Even treatises like Composition, Timus and the Laws, for example, improve its readability because they're conversational frame. Furthermore, the dialogue form allows Plato's evident interest in pedagogical questions. How is it possible to learn? What's the best way to learn? What sort of person can we learn? What sort of question, what is a person in position to learn? Beautiful. To be swayed not only in the content of compositions, but also in their form, if I can say so. Being able to podcast, for instance, is a particular form of writing. And so this is a podcast where it's a commented reading of a text, and it's in form, and it's made accessible, not to people at the moment, but being put into an application, which is a live, living application, is sort of a similar sort of thing. I'm supposing that some people will learn by listening to podcasts, and some people will have access to it on a dynamic level by application, but not everyone. Even in the Laws, such questions are not far from Plato's mind, as he demonstrates through the dialogue form, how it's possible for a citizen of Athens, Sparta and Crete to learn from each other by adapting and improving upon each other's social political institutions. In some of his works, it's evident that one of Plato's goals is to create a sense of puzzlement among its reader, and that the dialogue form is being used for this purpose. In Parmenides, which is perhaps the clearest example of such work, because here Plato relentlessly rubs his reader's face in a baffling series of unresolved puzzles and apparent contradictions. But several of his other works also have this character, though to a smaller degree. For example, in Protagoras, Can Virtue Be Taught? Hippias Minor, is voluntary wrongdoing better than involuntary wrongdoing? And portions of Meno, are some people virtuous because of divine inspiration? What I have to say is voluntary in doing is people may be involved in voluntary wrongdoing, but when they become aware of it, it's how they behave afterwards is just a real giveaway to the strength of their character. Just as someone who encounters Socrates in conversation should sometimes be puzzled about whether he means what he says or he is instead speaking ironically, well, I must admit, no. So Plato sometimes uses dialogue as a form to create in his readers a similar sense of discomfort about what he means and what we ought to infer from the arguments that have been presented to us. I just have to mention my aunt, who's a nun, she's alive, but unfortunately not mentally with us. But she used to use the fact that people really believe that truthful nuns, that she would invent a story in such a way that people would come, it's just a brilliant thing to come to realize that she was questioning their belief structure at a very, or get them to reflect on their belief structure at a very high level. I can't quite describe it, but she will say, people will talk about violins and she will say, oh, at Sancta Sophia we had a Stradivarius violin. Oh, yeah, well, where is it? Oh, we've lost it. Type of, you know, that's very, very simple type of stuff that she knew it was never to be true, but it was sort of a way of examining people, whether they were gullible or interested, or people would say if someone believed you, they would go across to someone else and people would explain that particular person is pulling your leg. I don't know, it's a complicated way of doing it. But Socrates does not always speak ironically, and similarly, Plato's dialogues are not always aimed at creating a sense of bafflement about what we are to think about the subjects under discussion. Of course, no wonder, mate. There's no mechanical rule for discovering how best to read a dialogue, no interpretive strategy that applies equally well to all his works. We will best understand Plato's works and profit most from our reading of them if we recognize the great diversity of styles and adapt a way of reading accordingly. Why not just rock up to the cinema and just have the experience and chat about it afterwards? Rather than impose our own reading of Plato, a uniform expectation of what we must be doing, because he has done such a thing elsewhere, we should bring each dialogue a receptivity to what is unique in it. It would be for the most fitting reaction to the artistry in his philosophy. And truly, I think that's really getting into it, in that one has to understand that Plato is actually not in the business of writing. There are playwrights who are in the business of getting their plays produced, like Andrew Lloyd Webber. There are other people who write plays and they just don't get... I sat down and wrote a play about Donald Trump, and I can't quite really remember it, but... the adults went out, and there was a storm, and the river was broken, and so everyone had to, the children were left in the village, and it's, Hill's Inn by Ivan Sathall was along the same line that someone pointed out to me, so bloody hell, it's not a really original idea. Well, I had one for a play that I'd written about Donald Trump, and how the people came back, and dressed up in their parents' clothes, so the son of the policeman dressed up as a policeman, and when people ignored him and laughed at him, he got really angry and began to threaten and behave as a policeman. And so there's the actual form of society had disappeared once the adults had gone, and we were actually playing with everyone who is not a genuine person in society. I've written a play on that. But for example, I wrote that as a play, but not to be produced an Andrew Lloyd Webber thing. I really can't remember. I should have kept it. Kept it more as a play. And similarly here, he's basically, Plato is a playwright. He's a non-commercial playwright. So for people who can read play scripts, and back then there was this position for plays, and indeed all the way through. And if you could like to say that Arthur C. Clarke is that tradition, Francis Bacon, Descartes, it's very interesting to see who did or didn't produce these various things. And it's to truly understand that the distinction between art and life, that we sort of now put art in art museums, and this public art, and it's become an institutionalized, whereas back then it was much more alive, and people could actually insert fairly complex meaning for things to actually serve things. It's like putting nutrient in the food chain, you know, putting a bit of iron in your cereal, a bit of iodine in your salt, getting that nutrient through there. So that's just my overall views. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll get this podcast out. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.